This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
All right, welcome to part two of episode 133 of the Partially Examined Life. We are talking about Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving. And last time, Seth had wrapped up by giving us a nice summary of the position and, in particular, the knowledge aspect, that love, to truly overcome the separateness of our existence, it involves knowledge, it involves epistemology, it involves wisdom, it involves not just snuggling up to something, but somehow understanding it.
Yeah, and knowledge is one of these four virtues: care, responsibility, and respect and knowledge. So I think because he calls back to them, we should just briefly say what they are. So care, for instance, he's thinking of care as in the mother's love, and he has a great line: love is the active concern for the life and the growth of that which we love. So by care, he just means the kind of love that makes us want to take care of something or someone.
Yes, define a term with itself. All right. Yes. No.
He does tell the story about Jonah, which I love. This
just gotta bring in freaking biblical stories.
Yeah.
Whenever he can.
Well, that's what they're good for.
Yeah.
That's what they're good for. You mean Jews? Is that what you're saying?
Biblical stories. Biblical stories are good for making points. That's what they are for. See, here's Jonah. Jonah didn't care. Jonah was selfish, and he ended up in the belly of a whale.
Symbolizes his isolation. So Jonah was more about justice than mercy.
But he was merging with the whale.
No, he was at the physical center of the whale, but not the spiritual center.
Oh. You know, I realize it's kind of an odd example for this one. So responsibility. He wants to say what your responsibility is.
It is responsibility. It is the ability to respond. So Heideggerian.
Yeah, so if you're not responsive, you can't be loving.
No, responsibility here just means that you have a feeling of responsibility for the other, not the ability to respond, but the sense that you...
He says that. I'm quoting.
No, he says to be responsible means to be able and ready to respond.
Yes, he does say that. And then he says he feels responsible for his fellow man as he feels responsible for himself. To say it's simply the ability to respond is...
He's trying to argue a little bit against the common sense notion of responsibility, where it's just you're to blame or something.
You have a burden.
Yeah, or duty, right.
Yeah, he says in the end, in the case of the mother and her infant, responsibility refers mainly to the care of physical needs. In the love between adults, it refers mainly to the psychic needs of the other person.
It is a weird way to define responsibility, don't you? If someone needs something from you and you can give that...
You wouldn't say that it's your duty to change your baby's diaper. Exactly, right?
So I guess if we've combined Seth's idea, someone has a need and it's not my duty to respond to the need. I feel responsible for that, meeting that person's need.
Yeah. If your wife is crying because she's heartbroken about the fact that her child's grown up and moved off to college, it's not your duty to go and console her, right?
Kant would say it's your duty.
Yeah, but Fromm is not saying that, right?
So, let me get respect. Responsibility could easily deteriorate into domination and possessiveness were it not for a third component of love, respect. So, acknowledging a person's unique individuality, not treating them as a means to an end or an object for my use.
Concern that the other person should grow and unfold as he is.
And then finally, respect requires knowing. Care and responsibility would be blind if they were not guided by knowledge. Seeing the other person on his own terms, seeing a person who is angry, looking deeper than that, not seeing them as an angry person, but as a suffering one.
Which I was trying to think about how just the way he puts this, what kind of therapist he was, because it seems like if you're a therapist in anything like the Freudian vein, you're not seeing the other person on his own terms. Yes, you do have some of these other things. You want them to flourish, but the point of being the therapist is not to see the other person in his own terms, to get beyond the limitations that the other person has in the way that they see themselves and pull the person's levers, really, or help them to pull their own levers to get past the bullshit. If you saw the other person in their own terms, that would be detrimental.
you have to get inside their heads. And if they're delusional, it doesn't mean that you share their delusion. But you need to be able to understand, to have some sort of empathetic understanding of why they're delusional, what put them in that position. So I think there's something to be said for that kind of understanding, even if you're, you know, at some level, you're not simply buying their story. This is the point where he gets into the secret and this desire to know someone so completely that you might even do that through torture and sadism and all these cruelty and destructiveness and those horrible things.
But he denies that that's really knowing, right? Because knowledge would be empty if it were not motivated by concern. So I took him to be in line with his criticisms of modern science as knowledge not properly guided by concern, for instance. That something like torturing someone to get to know who they are is knowledge run amok, not the kind of activity of knowledge that he's talking about. In fact, in this section, he explains that it has to be, you know, tempered, or it's part of this, these four aspects of love. So knowledge in, I guess, in the realm of the activity of love, which wouldn't do that, right?
He's setting us up for the path of love is knowing the secret. And he's going to say the only way of full knowledge lies in the act of love. So he doesn't say a lot about, at least here, about, you know, he does mention it. So, for instance, a child who takes something apart in order to know it, or even tears the wings off a butterfly, that kind of cruelty. So you could see that kind of sadism as having something to do with the scientific mode of approaching things.
Yep.
I just want to call back to the No Country for Old Men episode, where the sadistic killer in there, you know, he liked to look in the eyes of the people as they were dying. And
right.
That was one of the things. That's not scientific knowledge. That was an attempt to bond on a personal level.
Yeah.
And wordless. So it actually had some of the elements that Fromm is recommending, but just not so much the care and concern element.
Yeah. So Fromm gives this example from Isaac Babel quoting an officer in the Russian war who, you know, shooting someone wasn't good enough. So he says, with shooting, you'll never get at the soul, to where it is in a fellow and how it shows itself. So this idea of getting at someone's soul through cruelty, for Fromm, it's a degraded approach, of course. It's unclear here exactly what he would say about why it's the, why it's, I mean, we know why it's bad, but theoretically.
Yeah, so he contrasted at the end that another path of knowing the secret is love. Love is the act of penetration of the other person in which my desire to know is stilled by union. In the act of fusion, I know you, I know myself, I know everybody, and I know nothing. I know in the only way knowledge of that which is alive is possible for man, by the experience of union, not by any knowledge our thought can give. Sadism is motivated by the wish to know the secret, yet I remain as ignorant as I was before.
Right.
I have torn the other being apart limb from limb, yet all I have done is to destroy him. Love is the only way of knowledge, which in the act of union answers my quest. In the act of loving, of giving myself, in the act of penetrating the other person, I find myself, I discover myself, I discover us both, I discover man. So the way in which these other ways of knowing are corrupt is that they leave you isolated.
You're trying to know a person, and destroying them is not a good way to accomplish that. Yeah.
And you destroy the thing that you're making a union with. And therefore, what you've done is just isolated yourself. And so there's no way in which you've fulfilled the knowing or the love. I mean, that's why love is the way to get at that knowing.
So he brings in the command to know thyself in here, page 31. Even if we knew 1,000 times more of ourselves, we would never reach bottom. We would still remain an enigma to ourselves, as our fellow man would remain an enigma to us. The only way of full knowledge lies in the act of love. This act transcends thought. It transcends words. It is the daring plunge into the experience of union. However, knowledge and thought, that is psychological knowledge, is a necessary condition for full knowledge in the act of love. Really? So you need to know some psychology.
That's a funny thing coming from a psychologist.
Seems like there was no love before a certain point in history when psychology was developed. Am I reading that uncharitably?
Does that mean psychology in the technical sense, or does it mean psychology in the broad sense? I don't know. But basically, it's about overcoming this distorted picture of the other person, which will later on, he's going to tie that to narcissism. And so the way we misunderstand people all the time, we read them through our own lenses and our own particular needs and concerns. So again, that example of someone who's angry, and you could just see, oh, he's angry. Well, now I'm angry at that person. They shouldn't be angry. Or you see it as an indication of suffering that elicits empathy instead, for instance. So he talks about this looking at people objectively. You know, that would be a more objective, loving, because the two go together, way of seeing the person.
So we've talked about the idea that knowledge has an inherent sense of violence and oppression, right? So some of the things we've talked about on the podcast, it's knowledge as possession, as penetration, right? All these metaphors where the act of knowing, because it's inherently tied up with the notion of subjectivity and objectivity and intentionality, that it's asymmetric and has a violence inherent in it. Do you feel like his attempt to say that love is somehow knowledge, but knowledge tempered by care and respect, that it overcomes that objection? Or is the idea that is overall the whole framework, that the structure of love is union through knowledge, even if it's not conscious knowledge in the way that we think about it? Is there ultimately a problem there? Or do you think that throwing in these kind of mitigating factors somehow takes the sting out of using the metaphor of knowledge?
Is what's supposed to be harmful or aggressive about knowledge the propositional element? Because that's what he's offering an alternative to. In fact, I don't think I emphasized the words correctly when I was reading that quote about our know thyself. The only way of full knowledge lies in the act of love. In other words, it's not the act of love as opposed to knowing yourself. It's in the act of love. This act transcends thought. It transcends words. It is the daring plunge into the experience of union. So is it the fact that you're not trying to grasp it through language means it's less aggressive?
I suspect that that's the intention. But then does the use of the word knowledge even make sense at that point?
Well, clearly there are lots of kinds of knowledge that are not matters of explicit words. You know, this is not just a matter of gazing deeply into somebody's eyes, maybe as they die or during sex or something, but being attentive to them, being responsible in terms of responding to them. So the way that you know them is like he gives the example about being conscious of yourself. It's not being self-consciousness, being worried. It's paying attention to what you're doing, being in the moment, but being aware if your body is complaining, you know, if you're straining. So just think of this as an athlete or something. And so correspondingly, to really love somebody else is to, well, you could think of it very physically during sex, again, that you figure out technique by actually paying attention and responding to them. But then in the larger sense, living with this person, you know their needs. You might not be able to write them all down, but you could probably go on and on if you were asked about things about your beloved. At least you should be able to produce an endless number of facts, but those wouldn't exhaust what you know about them and the way that you know it.
Right. In other episodes, we've contrasted the notion. So we have knowledge understood as an act of reason. It's an intentional act, kind of bound up in the whole subjectivity, objectivity metaphysics. Then we've had practice, which is that Eastern thing about where we've struggled in the episodes, particularly on Zen and Taoism, about the idea that there's a type of knowledge that's a practical knowledge, not in an Aristotelian sense, but in the sense of knowledge that comes from practice, that it's not something that you can grasp with reason. And then we have apophantic, this idea of kind of sudden and immediate experience, which gives some kind of enlightenment or experience. And initially, what I thought he was saying was that the knowledge he's trying to describe, the art of loving, it's love as a practice, in the same way that we think of Eastern philosophers or Buddhists or whatever who meditate and they practice towards enlightenment. But now I'm not so sure that that's what he thinks he's driving at.
I don't know the, you know, what kind of knowledge is this, which I think is your question. I mean, it gets into later on into paradoxical logic and some of the Eastern philosophy stuff.
Seth, are you saying something like one of the ways in which we all always or often understand knowledge is taking things apart? And by understanding its part and how those parts are related to one another, we have knowledge. that doesn't seem to be this kind of thing he's talking about in terms of being directed always towards union.
I think that's kind of what I'm saying. I'm trying to relate this to other things that we've looked at over the years. So we have the notion of knowledge that is connected with reason, our typical philosophical, standard, scientific way of thinking about things, that we exercise our reason and there are rules and categories that are applied and we come to grasp a thing intellectually through its essence. That's one form. Then we have the notion of knowledge that is more practical, and sometimes we've seen it as knowledge that comes through practice in the form of craft, like a kind of knowledge that the master carpenter
has. Well, the art, yes. Yeah.
The art, right? And then we have the notion of, and this is kind of tenuous, but we've sort of played around with it in the past, of knowledge that comes through practice, not so much of an art of a craft, but the kind of knowledge that's more like enlightenment, where you meditate or you repeat certain activities over and over again. And it's not for the purpose of getting artful in the execution, but to having some kind of an epiphany or some kind of an experiential knowledge, let's call it. And then there's apophantic, as I mentioned, which is just Saul on the road to Damascus or whatever, where Saul becomes Paul. And initially, I thought what he was proposing here was something along the lines of more like the Buddhist enlightenment thing. But the more I think about it, the more I think that doesn't quite fit, because it's not like you practice and you practice and you practice with somebody for years and then suddenly you're in love with, oh, I finally attained enlightenment.
Yeah, no, it's not that for sure.
It's not that. It's not sudden, but it's also not something that you can do as a purely intellectual exercise. It's an art, but he's not buying into the whole Aristotelian concepts of praxis here. There's something else going on. There's kind of a little twist with this respect and care and the structure. And as he teases out in the latter half of the book, which I don't think we're going to have time to get to, these different forms of love, it's not simply that you work on the craft. That's too much like the creative act, right? Praxis, where you're like working on a shoe or you're a carpenter or something like that, is too objective, where you're investing yourself in the object. This is somehow different from that because there's another human being involved and it's not simply acting on an inanimate object. It's almost like this is the inverse of war. If we think about the art of war, not in a modern sense or a Sun Tzu sense, but like thinking in terms of Greek tradition, this idea that warcraft is an art and it does involve another human being. But in this case, you're talking about sort of the inverse of that. Instead of wanting to overcome or dominate the other, or in this case, it's care and respect.
Well, at least you're tying pretty directly into the next thing that's discussed in here, which is the connection with the love of God, which occupies quite a few pages here.
Well, actually, the next thing is love of parent and child.
And he gets into these different objects of love, right?
What we've just been discussing is the first part of the theory of love section is the love, the answer to the problem of human existence, and then we get into love between parent and child. And he starts out with the unconditional love of the mother, where, you know, as a child, you have the feeling eventually of I am loved because I am kind of thing. It can't be acquired, produced, or controlled. And then at some point, the father's love becomes relevant. The fatherly love is more conditional. It's more about being loved because you fulfill patriarchal society's expectations. You succeed at things. And again, when we're talking about mother and father, we're talking about the caveat that we're talking about motherly and fatherly principles, right? A mother or father could both play a maternal role or a fatherly role. So it's a kind of simple way of talking about things. So yeah, those are the two sort of main types of parental love.
I wrote so utterly mind-numbingly conventional and old-fashioned in my margin. Even with the qualification that they're meant to be categories, or that would be the generous interpretation.
We saw the same sort of idea in Lacan, right? The name of the father is the... So this idea that you start out in this situation of a symbiosis, think of it as a cell, and then the cell's got to divide. And so there's got to be a dividing principle, and the father becomes the severing principle.
The problem is that it prejudices the language by making it mother and father. And that's my reaction. In finding it be so old-fashioned and mind-numbingly conventional, just because...
Was your experience as a father that that's not true to your experience, the maternal bond being different than the paternal or...
No, of course not. Of course your love is unconditional in the same way. And both mother and father, conditional love is dickish love. Like,
yes. Yes.
So thinking that like it's any part of the parental role to express conditional love is ridiculous.
If you don't mow the lawn, when I tell you to,
I won't love you.
You know what? I'm just going to kind of stop hugging you a little bit.
Why is it that people develop an absurd need to succeed? You know, if you're wealthy, to send your kid to a very fancy preschool and set them up in that kind of competition immediately. So even if you think to yourself, yes, I love my child unconditionally, a lot of parents certainly are pressuring their kids and I think make it seem as if their love depends upon their accomplishments. I don't think that's some kind of uncommon thing in society.
Or resentment. There are certainly people that love their children unconditionally, but at the same time harbor some resentment.
Well, yeah, there's the complexity of, you know, having negative feelings towards one's kids as well. But I'm just saying that if everyone were loved unconditionally, you wouldn't see so many people driven in the way that they're driven to accomplish things.
I would say the establishment of expectations and the discipline and those kinds of things that are considered quote-unquote fatherly in Fromm, it's not clear to me that those are not just different than love. So yes, of course, part of my loving my child is going to be wanting them to grow and flourish. And part of them growing and flourishing successfully is to establish rules and boundaries. And that is part of them growing up to become an independent person. So that is an act of love. But it's not as if that in establishing those boundaries that I'm going to love them less because they rebelled against me or whatever. I might be annoyed and pissed off and all that stuff, but it's not that they have to come and get those little chits. You know, the characterization of that activity as love just seems so bizarre.
Yeah, but I think, you know, so as an infant, you know, there is still something conditional about that, right? Though if your child does something wrong and you're disappointed with them at some point in childhood, that's a terrible thing to happen. Daddy is disappointed in me.
Sure, absolutely.
Forget about mother and father. And think of two different types of love. One, which is totally unconditional, and the other kind, which is helping you individuate. And to do that, it has to set boundaries and it has to frustrate you. You know, it has to say, okay, get on the potty and do your thing. And if you don't do that, I'm going to be disappointed. Part of the motivation is they want to please you and they don't want to disappoint you. You know, or it could just be they're afraid of you. Hopefully it's not that. But it's so, you know, at some point there's a stick involved in helping this other person individuate. That's really the fundamental distinction we're trying to make. Helping someone grow by simply nurturing them or helping someone grow by giving them, you know, negative feedback essentially and setting up an ideal that is different from what they are. You should be the one who's potty trained. Ultimately, you should be a doctor, you know, if you have that kind of parent or any sort of ambitions that rise out of that, whether it's meeting parental expectations or meeting societal expectations. I think we're all saddled to some extent by that.
What I'm wondering aloud is whether training and education are the same thing as love.
Well, I think it's a matter of approval, you know, getting the approval of teachers or parents. And you could say, well, yeah, you may have lost my approval in a specific circumstance, but you didn't lose my love. But its significance, psychological significance, may still be the feeling of a loss of love. That may be the threat that's hanging over the kid, even if you as a parent don't feel that way, right? Obviously, you're not going to – being disappointed in your kid doesn't mean hating your kid or doesn't mean on a holistic level not loving your kid. But in a particular instance, it could feel like that to someone, and that could be the motivating factor. I'm just trying to get at this fundamental distinction between being worried about disappointing someone because you aren't meeting expectations and then being in the other place of I am loved because I am and there's nothing else. That unconditional love, none of us gets that in the end once we mature, unless we've met someone who's mastered the art of loving. Or I don't know, is he even saying that in the end? I'm not sure.
No, I think the implication we have to draw on here that part of the art of loving is paradoxically enough, to express conditional love in this way. In other words, to have training, to have care. Dylan is right. Like, calling it these two types of love just seems a little ridiculous. Like, these should just be two aspects of what it is to love something. That is, to express this underlying emotional support that's going to be consistent, is not going to go away no matter what you do, but then also to somehow give some sort of motivation. And it could just be that he's just describing fairly accurately how the division of labor went in households of at least his youth, if not the actual 50s in which he's talking.
Or in a patriarchal society, which I think many people still think we live in a patriarchal society. I mean, I think we have to leave aside the sociology and the question of the accuracy of whether it's the father, you know, even with his caveats of the extent over history to which it's been the father who has been the lawgiver as opposed to the mother. And we just have to accept these as two kind of generic principles. The lawgiving principle, which is the limiting and curtailing and individuating principle, and then the cohesiveness principle, the unconditional love part.
All right, can we move to God? Are we ready?
Good God.
How does he actually move from parent to God here?
Actually, the next section is the objects of love.
Yeah, he goes through brothers and mothers and the exotic. And
No exotic. The strange.
I wish there were a section on exotic love. So the brotherly love, it's not exclusive. It's the love of all human beings. So exactly the kind of thing we would think it is.
Yeah. This is all in the concept of objects of love.
So it's the recognition, he said, that we are all one. The differences between our various personalities is just so slight compared to all the similarities. And just expressing a basic empathy for people.
And it's this idea of the equality of human beings. And
yeah. The idea that it implies a love for everyone, including yourself. I think he's trying to cordon off the notion of selfless. And this goes back to that, what I was talking about, erotic love. I guess this is where you guys were saying that I was already jumping ahead to the second part. That to love some without loving all, whether that some is a one or a group, indicates that you don't have the capacity for love, true love, love that unites essences.
Yeah, so he says that at the end of this section, actually. Here lies the basic difference to erotic love. In erotic love, two people who are separate become one. In motherly love, two people who are one become separate. After brotherly love, he gets into this motherly love, which we've already talked about a little bit. But, you know, one of the aspects is this unconditional part of it. But there's preservation of the child's life and growth. And then there's this other it is good aspect. He compares that to the Genesis where God follows everything by saying it is good, or the land of milk and honey. Mothers provide both milk and honey. Although he does end up saying only a minority of mothers give honey. But the idea is to instill the sense that you are good and life is good. That's one of the mothering functions here.
I had wished that my mother had the honey boob installed.
Oh, God.
Part of the joy of doing this podcast is just Mark embarrassing Dylan, I have to say.
So then he talks of the narcissistic mother who could see a child as a way of meeting her own needs, not fostering the separation he talks about. But ultimately, you know, the true maternal function is to help the child separate. That's where we got the contrast between erotic and motherly love. So that's what leads into this next section on erotic love.
Hey, before we go any further, let's talk about our sponsor this time, The Great Courses.
We have been talking a lot about The Great Courses, and we are excited about their new Great Courses Plus video learning service, which we've talked about for the last couple of weeks. In case you're not familiar, it gives you unlimited access to a huge library of the Great Courses lecture series in tons of fascinating subjects. Philosophy, of course, history, science, photography, cooking. We love the Great Courses Plus, and they are giving you, our listeners, an incredible opportunity right now. You can watch one of their popular courses, The Fundamentals of Photography, absolutely free. The Fundamentals of Photography is filmed in partnership with the National Geographic and is taught by professional photographer Joel Sartore. Now, I've been watching it, as I've mentioned, for the last few weeks, and I really enjoy it. It's a great way to learn how to take stunning photographs just like a pro, which he is, helping to capture memories of what we see and experience. I've been watching Lecture 21, which is on problem solving, and he gives you a framework of four really good things to think about: composition, good light, background, and making sure that you're shooting an interesting subject. And he does a great job of exploring each one of those through different photographs that he's taken, showing you how he got through the thought process of getting to that photograph. Now, for a limited time, the Great Courses Plus is offering our listeners a chance to stream this course, The Fundamentals of Photography, which is a $235 value, as well as hundreds of other courses for free. You can stream from any internet-connected TV, PC, or through the Great Courses Plus apps. But this free offer is only available for a limited time, so hurry. To stream The Fundamentals of Photography from the Great Courses Plus for free, you must go to thegreatcoursesplus, PLUS.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
Now back to the show.
I'm skimming the erotic love section, and it just seems that we've said most of this already before.
It is the craving for complete fusion, for union with another person. Ta-da.
That's exotic love, right?
Well,
quite exotic.
Just remove the word person, then you have exotic love.
Then he gets into the section on self-love and distinguishing it from selfishness. I'm trying to give a sense in which self-love is actually a requirement. We can't love other people without loving ourselves, the kind of thing that is now very popular in self-help books. I don't know if Fromm was the first person to say this type of thing. He probably wasn't.
So he does say something in this section which I found a little bit strange. It makes sense in the context of what his bigger project, but he says, this is on page 55 in mine, which probably in Mark and yours is on 53, to love somebody is the actualization and concentration of the power to love. The basic affirmation contained in love is directed towards the beloved person as an incarnation of essentially human qualities. Love of one person implies love of man as such. At that point, I felt like, well, then why are there any different kinds of objects of love anyway? I just found it kind of weird.
Well, it's a very high standard, right, to say that. So normally we think of this Christian ideal of loving thy neighbor as thyself as an ideal, and we don't think of our personal relationships as depending on that ability. But Fromm is, you know, raising the bar very high. He's saying that to truly love in our personal relationships, we have to love that person the same way. It's not that we can't also love them erotically and in other ways, but we have to be able to love them as we would in that love thy neighbor sense.
I guess it depends on how you take implies. He's making it's almost like a kind of political statement you would make when you try to link the love that we have for our spouses or our family to the love of neighbors, to the love of our community, to say we're all not so different from one another, and so forth and so on.
It just seems to be, the point is that you have to have an openness, that you can't love an individual person unless you have just this openness, this attentiveness, and that's going to not be something that you can just turn on with your significant other and turn off with everybody else if it's actually an authentic thing. And so you have to have the kind of curiosity the kind of openness that would make you, when you run into a stranger and get in, you know, would make you want to strike up a conversation and get to know them and not just treat them like an object or an impediment or ignore them.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way of putting it. The idea that you have to have this almost Christ-like ability to engage the poor and the destitute and what have you, if you're capable of having any kind of relationship with somebody else.
There's a very elitist, or he says it a few points, that in our society today, there are not really many people who are really capable of loving in the fullest sense.
At the end of the essay, page 113, I should add here that it's just as important to avoid trivial conversation. It's important to avoid bad company. By bad company, I do not refer only to people who are vicious.
To the band.
Bad company. Because I can't.
Definitely that. Avoid that van.
Damn. Bad company. Are there any living members left you can interview on your podcast, Mark?
Yes. Paul Rogers, sure.
Wow. Apparently you haven't been avoiding them, if you know that much about them.
Anyway, he says that we should avoid their company because their orbit is poisonous and depressing. I mean, also the company of zombies, of people whose soul is dead, although their body's alive, of people whose thoughts and conversations are trivial, who chatter instead of talk, who assert cliche opinions instead of thinking. So this is, I think, in a very practical matter, like, well, why don't you go and help those who are less fortunate? Well, I mean, obviously there are a lot of different excuses one could give for that, but one of them is, I recall when Wes and I were roommates in Austin, there was some like homeless guy that just wanted us to let him in. It was raining outside and he came like knocking on our door. I think we might have given him money earlier, or I did, or something. And we didn't let that guy in because of course we're scared of letting some random stranger into our.
Also, didn't he see the picture of Ayn Rand that I had taped to the door? Was he thinking he's going to get money out of us? No. Or shelter out of us. I have no memory of that incident, by the way.
You know, the idea that of going around as an open sore, as an open book, wanting to take in every stranger and love every stranger, geez, that's scary.
It would be self-annihilating, yeah.
Yes, because a lot of people are going to take advantage of that, are going to be hostile, or, you know, certainly we are overly timid and...
Well, nowhere does he prescribe that we have to become... Where does he talk about becoming a monk or something like that?
Well, okay, page 131. Does loving everybody, does that not imply giving up all one's secular concerns and sharing the life of the poorest?
There we go.
This question has been raised and answered in a radical way by the Christian monks who share the opinion of the basic incompatibility between love and normal secular life within our society. They arrive at the result that to speak of love today means only to participate in the general fraud. They claim that only a martyr or a mad person can love in the world of today. Hence, all discussion of love is nothing but preaching. He says, this very respectable viewpoint lends itself readily to a rationalization of cynicism, shared implicitly by the average person who feels, I would like to be a good Christian, but I would have to starve if I meant it seriously. This so-called radicalism results in moral nihilism. Both the radical thinkers and the average person are unloving automatons, and the only difference between them is that the latter is not aware of it, while the former knows it and recognizes the so-called historical necessity of this fact.
So after those polemics, he does say that the principle underlying capitalistic society and the principle underlying love are incompatible, because it sounds like the people he's responding to think that it's impossible to love within this type of society. That's why we have to withdraw from it. Then he goes on to say, yeah, it's hard. And then says, love is by necessity a marginal phenomenon in present Western day society. But nevertheless, people are capable of love and it's still possible. It does seem like preaching to me. I mean, at some point he's prescribing, you know, you shouldn't read stories or watch TV. Or he said you should spend your time reading, but not with stories or TV or something like that.
With a minimal number of mysteries and other kinds of lightweight stuff.
I mean, you see the sort of strain in these early critical theorists in general. I mean, when we read Adorno coming up at the culture industry, you'll see many of these types of kind of moralism about entertainment and trivial pursuits and things like that. So there's what I'm trying to get at. I do think there is a moralistic and maybe unrealistic edge to all of this. This idea that only a few will love, and yes, in some very elite sense, okay. But do average people just living their lives, are they failing to love just because they have to go to an office and come back and deal with all the bullshit that we all have to deal with? Yes, if you give this very elitist kind of definition to love. I wonder if anyone in any type of society, right, no matter how saintly they are, whether they really meet that standard.
Right. So there's both a high bar of psychological health. There's three elements that we haven't really covered yet that we just at least need to mention before we wrap up here. One is the love of God thing, which is related very closely, branches out of this love of everyone, that it's just sort of general love of nature. And then he reflects on different ways in which people actually claim to love God, and in sort of the feeling of Kierkegaard or Schleiermacher, condemns the herd type of religion as being infantile in some way, that they love God like the father who they have to please, or like the mother who they don't have to do anything to please, according to his earlier analysis. So we've got that part. We've got the social commentary of how should society be transformed? And you were just referring to that about being at the office. And this reminds me a lot of our new work episode and the Hannah Arendt. And then the third bit is just the positive, how to change your mind, how to make yourself a virtuous kind of person who can love. So all these things are connected, that having the right kind of society, of course, would let us develop into the right kind of people. And being the right kind of person to be authentic, to be paying attention to the world around you, to not, like you were saying, get sucked up into trivialities of various sorts, either intentionally through these trivial entertainments, you know, to be a deeply spiritual person, or through economic circumstances that make us, to stay alive, have to focus on trivial bullshit just as a matter of course, as a matter of the regular thing, so that when you stop and are philosophical, that ends up being the exception. No, we need a society in which somehow people can be truly themselves and truly centered all the time. And then one of the expressions of that is what corresponds in the finest kind of religion to the love of God. But he has some interesting things to say about that, which make it, you know, explicitly, when he goes through sort of the history of religion, that the most developed kind of religion is more like Spinoza's kind of religion, which, if you know anything about Spinoza and the way he was criticized, is basically atheism. That he's playing very much in the type of enlightened modern Judaism who they like Maimonides, and our episode on that you can listen to, of how stop talking about all the greatness that God has and all the positive attributes that God has. Really getting at God means saying, no, no, whatever God is, it's greater than those things. It's greater than greatness. It's greater than goodness. It is simply something that is too great for our minds to get a handle on. And once we start thinking about God in that way, we start thinking about God just as a sort of principle of justice, as something that is not a father.
He's also moving us away from this idea that he attributes to Western civilization of thinking of God as an object of knowledge or belief, and turning us towards this idea. You know, so he says in Brahmanism as well as in Buddhism and Taoism, the ultimate aim of religion is not the right belief, but the right action. So this turn towards action, because again, he's interested in art and practice, this idea that you give up God as a, again, as an object of thought, and it becomes more about a way of living. You know, he ends that section on God associating these paternalistic or maternalistic religions. He calls them infantile and not mature, and he associates those with submission to the market and conformism in a capitalist society and that type of thing. So the social structures of our societies have something to do with this. And in the chapter 3, he's going to talk about the way in which social structure can affect the way we love and be an obstacle to it, kind of deform it or degrade it.
I was resisting when he brought in this love of God thing for exactly the reason that we were talking about before, because we want love, based on his own description, to be something that is interactive. And so even love of humanity as a whole, well, that's still interactive, or love of nature in that you are going out and helping nature, you're interacting in a positive way with animals. There's some sort of positive feedback loop. It's not just you and your own imagination. But when you get to love of God, that seems a little more problematic, unless you think that God is a spiritual being that comes and messes with you. But then reading further, the way he interprets God, no, it really is just loving God is the same as being centered and being in tune with the world around you and acting ethically.
His dating profile would say spiritual but not religious, I think it's safe to say.
Leans Buddhist.
And he's got this whole thing in there about the difference between Aristotelian logic and paradoxical logic, and how that's related to this apophatic, Not apophantic. No, no, they're both real words. They're just different words. I looked them up while you were talking.
It's not apophantic.
But I will leave the listeners to look them up. It's not worth our time to distinguish them. But the apophatic religion is the kind that you can't put it into words. It is the thing that comes out of that Maimonides negative theology tradition, and that then yields so nicely to some kind of mysticism. And mysticism and emphasis on practical action. Strange that those would go together, but they're both nonverbal.
You think too long, you're wrong.
So anything else about any of those three points that interested the rest of you about the love of God, how do we transform society, or how do we be a centered, awesome person?
I think we should say something if we want to touch on anything in these last chapters.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was trying to sum up what's in the chapters that we hadn't gotten to yet.
Oh.
No, he's guiding us to the end. He's exerting his fatherly principle.
And if you don't do it, I won't love you.
Will our audience love us?
So let's come up with some interesting points from these last parts that you guys wanted to talk about.
Well, the biggest one is the rational faith stuff.
Yeah.
In the practice of love. Love's disintegration in Western society is really just a recapitulation of the very beginning and maybe extension of it, that one of the problems of Western society is that love has gone away. Now, you know, this is a capitalist kind of critique and so forth. And
it's turned us into automatons who...
Automatons, yeah.
We are Devo.
It's familiar and not so interesting.
I think it's a good summary of that chapter.
But in the practice of love, where he basically starts with some, you know, not dumb, but sort of straightforward, sort of self-helpy, but again, not stupid, characteristics of basically training, and how the practice of love is like any other kind of practice of anything. It requires discipline, concentration, patience, supreme concern, that is focus. And then he goes on to talk about how you do these, which basically amount to you need to develop a habit of concentrating and focusing yourself. But then he gets on at the end to this notion of needing faith. And this is part of how you emerge out of your own narcissism, out of your, he says, the ability to love depends upon one's capacity to emerge from narcissism, from the incestuous fixation to mother and clan. It depends on our capacity to grow, to develop a productive orientation in our relationship toward the world and ourselves. This process of emergence, of birth, of waking up, requires one quality as a necessary condition, faith. The practice of the art of loving requires the practice of faith. He's clearly using the word faith a little bit provocatively because, you know, he wants to say, oh, you think I'm talking about religion, don't you? But no, I'm not really talking about religion. I'm talking about rational faith. So rational faith is a conviction which is rooted in one's own experience of thought or feeling. Rational faith is not primarily belief in something, but the quality of certainty and firmness which our convictions have. Faith is a character trait pervading the whole personality rather than a specific belief. And so this rational faith ends up being faith and rationality.
Yeah, later on he'll say, well, he'll give this basis of rational faith is productiveness. To live by our faith means to live productively. You know, so he goes on to contrast irrational faith is rooted in submission to, you know, the higher power. It's really rational faith is about our faith in our own powers to some extent.
Yeah, exactly. That really brings home the notion which him using the word faith is provocative, right? Because in the end, he categorizes everything that you would sort of typically put under that rubric as being irrational.
Yeah.
Second-rate faith. And in fact, maybe even part of the problem of submission to tyranny and poor living and maybe bad hygiene. I don't know.
And it would make sense if he says that to excel in an art is to focus your entire life on it, that all these different elements of things he's recommending end up being basically one and the same thing. That having rational faith and having self-esteem are the same thing, right? Because that's having rational faith in yourself. That even if I have failings, I have faith that I can do it. I can work hard and I can make myself better. And that's the way you could have empathy with other people. That unlike the situation where I was describing where we or maybe I was afraid of letting the homeless person in the rainstorm into our house, we should have faith. We should be able to say other people are just like me. They're not around. They're not trying to screw everything up. They're trying to live with some comfort, you know, just have a little bit of faith that people are going to act like human beings, at least, you know, until you're shown otherwise. And then if there's an exception, don't let that taint your view of all of humanity. And really, he says, even though this society is really messed up, it is not present a forum where you expect why I would be in this situation of not wanting to let the homeless guy. Well, that's because we're not in a culture where people do that. We are not in a culture where people support each other, where our relation to each other is primarily economic. And so we would expect other people to get their shit together and go get a job or whatever and not be homeless. Like, that's just sort of written in the social contract. So, and our society is still better off in a lot of ways than many older societies. And so we've never actually had a society, perhaps, that has been optimally conducive to love of the sort he's describing. But yet, we need to have faith in humanity, in our potential to progress, in our potential to realize what it is we really need and do intelligent things to construct our society in that way. And so, despite the existence of Donald Trump, we need to have faith in humanity. Do you have it? Because if you don't have it, you can't love. Sorry. It's a high bar. Who else wants to go? What'd you get out of this?
Well, so I was unexpectedly pleased by the reading. It was nice to have something that wasn't as taxing to read, but also there's a pretty strong structure and flow to at least the first part. I thought the second part on practice was almost incomprehensible, but the first part on, you know, the theory of it, where he lays out these different paradigms or structures, the paternal, the fraternal, the maternal, and so on, it made a lot of sense to me. Whether it was dumbed down or not nuanced enough, I don't know, but there were some very serious anchors there, and it was a sufficiently meaty and clearly enough laid out to form a basis for him to say, in order for you to love fully, you need to encounter and overcome or incorporate or whatever, all these different things. So I thought that was fine. I thought, like I said, the practice part just seemed kind of rambling and disassociated and wasn't very particularly helpful. But I enjoyed it. It is definitely a product of its time, but I get why it was so popular. And I thought it was a perfectly appropriate reading for this time and for us to kind of take a break after Aristotle, and I guess you guys had just done the Stoics. By the way, I tried to listen to the Stoic episode that you guys just did without me in preparation for this because Mark said there was going to be some kind of connection talking about love. And I finally had the experience that so many of our fans do where I fell asleep listening to one of our episodes. It was glorious.
Yeah. So it was a good experience to fall asleep.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was so nice.
Was it because it was boring or
no,
because it was?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Well, I sometimes listen to podcasts or audiobooks rather than read. And it's just a very soothing and calming way to transition from waking state to sleep.
Huh. Well, can I say this book, despite its breeziness, transitioned to me to sleep several times. I actually found it really hard.
Yeah, I got sleepy and bored.
Really?
Reading it. Actually, yeah. Actually, it's funny. I think, you know, they should put Seth's and Dylan's, some of their evaluations on the dust jacket, like perfectly appropriate or not too taxing or not stupid.
Seth, you mentioned trying to get your wife to read this, that, yeah, I kind of had the same feeling, like, you should read this. Then you'll do more to try to understand me. We should engage each other. We should try to understand each other better. Come on.
You know, I didn't really even think of it that way, Mark. I just thought it would be the kind of thing that she would appreciate and get something out of. I can say this. I know my wife well enough to know that if I suggest something for her to read or to look at, she will not at all get out of it whatever I think or intend that she should. So I've stopped trying to pin my hopes on such things, and I just think she would have appreciated it.
Read this part about motherly and fatherly love. This is what I'm going for.
Yeah.
Dylan?
Well, it wasn't stupid. I basically felt the same way as Seth did. It was easy to read. It was, I wouldn't call it you know, surprising or deeply thought-provoking, but I thought it was sort of a nice articulation overall of an idea that love is actually an activity that we do rather than something that happens to us. And overall, I think that he made that case reasonably well. It is a product of its time and probably a product of his time in part due to it being, you know, a popular book. And so those things probably go hand in hand. I did find the last two sections, the one on disintegration of Western society, you know, sort of ho-hum. And the last section on practice, yeah, also, you know, ho-hum, but maybe a little less ho-hum. Certainly the most interesting part is the first sort of two-thirds about the theory of love and so forth.
You're not going to run out and get his book, The Sane Society, where I guess he elaborates how we should fix the world and make it sort of Marxist, but not.
I wouldn't object to reading more of him, but reading this book didn't make me feel like, gosh, I'm really, really interested in what this guy has to say and want to go read some more. But I didn't find him revolting or anything either. So I was like, oh, you know.
Yeah, I'm hoping there's something with more substance, because the weird experience of recommending this book is I realized that, you know, I grew up with this mom who had all these shelves full of books, and that was one of my primary ways of relating to her. And even as a young child, I was looking at these books. So when I say, oh yeah, Eric Fromm's Art of Loving, that's a great book, I really don't even know that. It's just, it was part of my childhood. So it's a weird, you know.
A sentimental love, not a real love.
I have a few Eric Fromm, yeah, books on my shelf. And I've looked at them and I thought, yeah, this guy would be fascinating to read. And I know he was influenced by and also dated Karen Horney, who's a psychoanalyst who I think is a great writer. And although maybe if I went back and looked at, you know, she's writing for a popular audience as well. Maybe it's just I've been spoiled by reading all this technical stuff for so long, but it all seems fluffy at this point. I don't know. It's interesting to see him translate certain philosophical and psychoanalytic concepts for a popular audience, but it seems like he's a little too watered down for my tastes.
He does name drop a lot.
Jonah.
He's not observing our podcast rules. You know, so The Sane Society, if there was something with more substance to it, I'd be up for reading more. But if it's the same kind of popularization at this point, after years of reading the stuff we've been reading, it doesn't do it for me. Let's put it that way. Maybe I'm a masochist or a sadist.
Sane Society is 1955. The first one is Escape from Freedom, which is about the Holocaust.
I remember picking up Escape from Freedom years ago and just being totally fascinated by it.
So, I mean, it would be nice to see more justification of anything. Like when Freud says something that you don't get, at least you know that somewhere there are clinical notes that back up what he's talking about. And here, I just don't know. I don't know whether to respect him enough as a psychoanalyst or whether he really is just kind of a humanistic philosopher.
His reading of Freud is not a professional's reading of Freud. It's wrong. It's someone who's casually acquainted with Freud. That worries me with regard to, you know, what kind of substance is in and how much does he even know about Marx and Weber and all that stuff. I don't know.
I mean, I certainly find it intriguing. I would be interested to hear what he, I think I would probably not like it, what he's actually recommending for social change. But certainly he's identified the same problem that we found in these other episodes about the problem of work and alienation and just living in a shallow way. And can't we get a society that would put us in a position that would encourage us to be more philosophical? That would be great.
Well, you'll see some of this, you know, when we get to the Adorno dialectic of the Enlightenment, you're going to see many of the same themes, obviously, and the critique of culture and capitalism. And yeah, you know, I'll be interested to see what you guys think of how substantial that is and how, you know, to me, the neo-Marxists and the critical theorists, I begin to wonder at some point how much they're actually contributing or whether they're just beating this particular drum about ideology over and over again. And applying it, you know, cultural ideology is responsible for everything and movies aren't good for you, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and I did find the last chapter on the positive. I found it very coherent and intriguing, but very demanding. It's another one of those things that made me feel bad about myself in terms of, you know, how comfortable are you being alone and not checking your phone every 5 minutes and just being the kind of person who can concentrate and therefore can listen very well to your spouse or whoever, to really to anybody that is talking to you. It is overly simplistic and in some ways not very helpful because he's talking about symptoms and he's not necessarily giving you, it's not very successful as a self-help book. And he says it's not going to be successful when he says, yeah, people have a problem that they should be asleep at night and awake during the day and not at this halfway in between and kind of drowsy, but then staying up too late. Like, yeah, okay, that's a problem that I identify in my own life.
But also the question is, what extent are these things really cultural? To what extent is it really a product of capitalism? Or reading Thoreau, Walden, we heard exactly the same types of critiques, but he was talking about how the telegraph had ruined society. Everything's happening so quickly and people are obsessed with the news. And it's the same refrain you hear over and over again. So I wonder if it's not sort of an idealization, this ideal of the society where people aren't distracting themselves, where they're connected to themselves and nature and other people, or if it's just inherently human for us to be doing these sorts of things, if it's less cultural and it's more the product of basic psychosocial pressures that show up throughout history.
And also nostalgia. I mean, in the Phaedrus, Socrates laments the use of writing.
Yeah.
To, you know, distract ourselves from the conversation in exactly the same way of the examples that you just gave.
And I could see a modern work, you know, of self-help addressing some of these same things by just giving you a more strict exercise regimen. Like, that's going to solve a lot of your problem. You having trouble concentrating, better diet, better exercise. Like, there are physical things that I didn't see addressed here. It all has to be a social psychological problem. The problem is never simply something that could be fixed physically. But maybe that's in the sane society. Maybe the sane society has a lot of push-ups.
More push-ups, man.
I have to read that another time. No, there are no knee bends in the sane society. Those are dangerous. Come on.
He did co-write a book with Richard Simmons, actually.
Weightless squats.
All right. Thanks, guys. Happy Valentine's Day to you and to everybody. Why don't you just, it seems like unless you can express your love really giving, that it gives you back. So giving a donation of some sort, investing yourself, becoming one with the Partially Examined Life through a membership, a citizenship, it seems like that would be very rewarding. So why don't you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and look about making a contribution or buying something from our store. Big donors since last time have included Kim Stout, Frank Netzlaff, Rob Forsyth, Eric Moss, Rowena Alberga, Emilio Spadola, Clay Olson, Gail Rodney, Duto Design, H. Tallboys, Catherine Milne, Judith Mason, Greg Kellermeyer, Ryan Hinckley, Lori Kelly, Ed Ferrasquilla, David Menares, Carl Severin, Ryan Ziegler, Jimmy Miller, Mihai Olteanu, Austin Heath, Kelly Rankin, Warwick Powell, Work of Wolves, J.F. Seymour Art, Stuart Finn, Miles Vender, Brian Weiss, Walter Morris, Brent Dahlgren, Janine Mackey, Richard Raposa, Justin Biancardi, Paul Hartigan, Matthew Stecky, Jacopo Lenzi, Diana Lalonde, Donald Freeman, Michael Pettit, Marianne Janek, Michelle Lynch, Stephen Riley, Tim Beeler, Henri Lipton, Kurt Gallagher, Laura Kiris, Stephen Shapiro, Federico Vicaro, Devin Sandberg, Jeannie Carey, Thomas Seedhall, Randall Rose, and David Kling. And thanks to all those who, you know, just joined on the $5 level. It really helps. It helps us be excited to do this, to have a...
And I will now read all of those. Sorry.
Mark, do we have any calendars left?
We have a lot of calendars left. Please buy a damn calendar. We'll keep that same offer that we had going of if you become a new $50 a year citizen, then we'll actually send you a coupon to get the calendar free. You still have to pay shipping. Hey, next time we're going to be reading parts of Hegel's Science of Logic, sections 1 through 129, the so-called Greater Logic, and the Encyclopedia Logic, or the Lesser Logic, sections 1 through 25. But you don't have to remember that because you should check out our new page, partiallyexaminedlife.com/upcoming, and that will always list what is going to be on the next episode, and so you could read along. Thanks to everybody. Go to our Facebook page. Go, hey, you should check out my new other podcast, Nakedly Examined Music. It's at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Go subscribe to it on iTunes. Leave a nice review for that. Hey, leave, if you enjoyed this, leave a nice review for us on the Partially Examined Life thing. If you haven't done that yet, can you really feel love?
If you don't love us, you can't love anyone else.
Oh, and just to give an account of the weirdness that you're about to hear, musically, in keeping with our Valentine's themes, we've got two short songs. One recorded Valentine's 1995. The other, its sequel in 2002. So I guess this is, in real life, what I consider expressions of love to amount to. You can decide whether they are mature in the way that Eric Fromm would approve of.
All right, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
What is that? The ultimate supercharged darling. She is such an awesome babe. She is certainly my fave. Give me, give me. She is so enticing that she makes me drool and ache. She is so exciting, much more so than she can make. Gimme, gimme. She is so much cooler than anyone I know. Gimme, 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 gimme. Let's she's so fine, I'm an arrow, and she's my wife. She's an apple, I'm a star. I'm hungry, she's my daughter. She's a goddess, she's so perfect. She's the bestest, she's the tragic. She's my darling, she's the one. She's like heaven, set more fun. She's beautiful, marvelous, spectacular, fabulous, delicious, magical, lavish, lip of your swell, 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 swell.
First taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.